Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Ron, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Happy to be with you.
So, Ron, we made it through our first party primary system in a long time, I guess unscathed. A lot of people still not happy, though.
No, and I'm not happy. And, of course, we're only two-thirds of the way finished this election cycle because we still have a general election after all of
right.
this. And under the old system, we'd be finished by now. You know, we would have had an open primary, and everybody could have voted, and all the candidates could have run, and then we would have had a runoff, and everybody could have voted, and all the candidates could have run who qualified for it, and then that would have been it. But of course, now we've got to go back to work and have a general election, even though the outcome really isn't particularly in doubt. It's still another process to go through.
Yeah. Let's focus on the Senate race for a moment. Obviously, I guess the party, the Republican Party, that is, thought that there probably wouldn't be this kind of second primary of the party primary system, because they very much wanted to be able to anoint someone, and that was going to be the end of the story. The political hierarchy was behind one candidate and one candidate only. Not surprising that she won, Congresswoman Julia Letlow. But it didn't end up being quite as close as what a lot of folks thought in the end. Your thoughts?
Well, that's right. There were a number of polls that came out in the last couple of weeks that showed the race either tied or nearly tied or actually had Fleming ahead by a few points. And I think that created a sense in the public and maybe even in the campaigns that the race was closer than it was. One of the things I think we have learned from history on this is that the Trump vote generally shows up on election day better than predicted. We've seen it every time Trump has run. He's always run a little better in the end than most people thought he would, or even most polls expected he would. And a lot of that has to do with voter turnout. And, you know, you had very low turnout in this election. And it didn't take much to affect that. So, you know, it's kind of complicated to explain and to figure out, but I think the bottom line is it's hard to poll these types of primaries, because the lower the turnout, the more anything that affects turnout has a bigger impact. You know, if you've got something that affects turnout by a point or two in a race with a 15-point turnout, that's a lot. If it's a 60% turnout, a point or two isn't as much. So I think that's one thing. And I think the other thing, too, is it was a peculiar election in the sense that it started off about Bill Cassidy. And you either wanted to reelect him or defeat him. And then it ended up not about Bill Cassidy, about two other candidates, who most people in the state, even though they heard their names, I just don't think they knew them very well.
Yeah, no, I would agree, certainly. And I think in those types of circumstances, the point that you made to start off with is that Trump voter comes shining through more so in that scenario than any other, right?
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's really what we saw.
Yeah, let's talk about the PSC race, which I thought was very interesting. John Young, who's run for a number of political offices against Stephanie Hilferty, it was a race that I thought was going to end up being a lot closer than it was. Ms. Hilferty, who serves in the state legislature, ended up with 62% of the vote to John Young's 38% of the vote. And she beat him in his home parish. And anytime you see that, that to me means you're in big time trouble.
Yeah, I think she ran an excellent campaign. A lot of it was below radar. It wasn't something you would see on TV or hear on the radio. But a lot of it was social media. A lot of it was her going place to place, working audiences. And she put together a tremendous amount of political support in terms of local government officials, because this district wasn't just Orleans and Jefferson. You had, I think, portions of eight other parishes. So
ten in total, yeah.
District. Yeah, I think so. And I just think she had a better campaign. But you know, there's one other thing that I think is interesting about both this race and the Senate race, and let's not forget, both were Republican primaries. They weren't general elections, but it's the fact that I think voters are looking for younger candidates right now. And in the case of the Senate race, you know, Letlow is 45, and Fleming is, I believe he's going to be 75 this week or next week. And, you know, that's a big difference. And in the case of Hilferty and Young, you know, Young has been around for a long time. It was parish president some years ago. And Hilferty, even though she's been in the legislature for a while, you know, she hasn't been running anything and hasn't been, you know, in the news in the middle of controversies for years. And so I think the age factor, or if not age, as much as generational, I think played a role there. I think we're going to see it play a role in the next presidential elections.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. Hadn't really thought about it, because I guess a lot of these folks are close to being my age group and, you know, my peers, and I don't think about being that old.
Well, neither do I. But when I look at myself in the mirror,
if I'm going to be totally transparent about it, let's pivot real quick to the Democratic Party. There's been a lot of consternation, a lot of folks upset with the Democrat primary system not getting a lot of coverage by the media or otherwise. And I guess we've got to the point now where there's, I think I saw a story the other day, there are more Republican registered voters than Democrats for the first time in the history of the state of Louisiana, or something along those lines. And I guess everybody kind of views us as a red state. So it's almost as though we look upon the Democratic primary system as being inconsequential.
Well, and you know, it has become that, and it doesn't have a whole lot to do with voter registration, because most of I still call us independents, even though we're all now not no party voters, but the number of Republicans and Democrats are close, even though Republicans are winning all the statewide elections, and it's because more independents are voting Republican than voting Democrats. The independents may not feel comfortable in a party, but they tend to be more conservative than liberals. So that's really what's been happening.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see as we move forward how this plays out. Let's pivot one more time To the Bessie board, Joseph Gao wins 52-48, very close race. He runs from a base of, I guess he's still out in New Orleans East and was able to pull it out. That's a four-parish race. I thought he ran a good race.
Well, you know, he did. He was elected to Congress some years ago. I defeated Bill Jefferson. He was in office for one term. And then was defeated for re-election in a landslide. And, you know, and ever since then, he's been trying to find a place, a spot for himself. And you know, the thing about the Bessie board is Bessie board campaigns, for the most part, are pretty quiet affairs. People really don't even know they're going on. And only until the end of this race was there any action to it. And both of them sort of started slugging a little bit in the end. And that's because of money. They only have so much money, and they can't spend money for months. They have to do it in a matter of days. And you know, but it ended up as a close race. And so now he's got the job. And the other candidate, Ellie Schroeder, is the wife of former state treasurer John Schroeder, who ran for governor. So they're still in politics and still running for office as well.
Yeah. There was a lot of concern on the North Shore in light of the most recent happenstance with Sheriff Randy Smith resigning as a result of his actions, whether or not there would be kind of a voter betrayal of the St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Office, but they end up renewing their millage of 4.31 mils by 65 to 35. I didn't think it was ever at risk. I think the St. Tammany voter was going to be a lot smarter than what I just said about the alternative, and they proved it.
Yeah, and I think the big thing here was how, you know, the incumbent did resign. I mean, it wasn't a long, drawn-out thing with a lot of controversy. It happened quick, and it happened before the election. And I think it gave voters a sense, well, it was a problem, but it was cleaned up pretty quickly, and now let's move on. And so I think ultimately voters were voting on the issue and not voting on personalities or against the former sheriff, because he wasn't there anymore.
Yeah. Ron, when we look back, and, you know, there's a lot of folks talking and very upset now about some of the line item vetoes that were made by the governor, you know, saying that a lot of it seems to have fallen in Democrat districts. I kind of always chuckle because, you know, I think they were the ones that coined the phrase that elections have consequences, but nobody ever likes to face the consequence, right?
Right. Well, you know, the line item veto is something that Louisiana's had for a long time. It's been used often by both Democratic and Republican governors. And probably more than anything else, it's really a key source of the governor's power, because it gives him such control over the legislative process. Now, you know, that can be overridden like anything else, but it takes a two-thirds vote to override the veto. But it is something that governors have used. They've always used it to exercise their power and to get what they want policy-wise. And one of the things, some years ago, there was a significant movement around the country to support line item vetoes and to give the president the line item veto. And the idea of that wasn't so much to increase the power, but to give the president, as a lot of governors have, the power to cut spending, to cut out programs that maybe a legislator needed to pass for their district, and that didn't necessarily meet the test of urgency for the state as a whole. And so it was really seen as a good government reform, a way to cut unnecessary spending out. Now, at the same time, it, like most of these things, it does increase the power of the governor. So there you have it, but it's there, and governors use it, and they have the right to use it.
Well, it's not surprising, too, right? I mean, when you think about the move that was afoot at the federal level to cut back spending, whether it was going to be Elon Musk or whatever they were going to coin the next program to try and do so. You've seen a lot of states mimic that. This state is mimicking it, and it probably should, because it finds itself, I think, in a deficit posture as well. And then you have a number of jurisdictions across the state that find themselves down and out too. But at some point in time, you know, and I said this in my monologue this morning, you need to wean yourself off of this higher level financial tits, so to speak, and take control and take ownership of what it is that you want to do at a local level, especially something that is totally local in nature, and not be looking somewhere else as a beggar, you know, to get money, because everyone is facing the same shortfalls and the same challenges from top to bottom.
That's true, but when you're in the legislative process and you need somebody's vote on a bill, and they say, well, I'll vote for it, but I need you to help fund this, you know, auditorium in a school I have. And so they say, okay, go ahead and do it, you know. And that's, you know, in Washington, they call those earmarks, that you don't take your chance going through the bureaucracy. You just get the legislature to say this is what the money is for. So, you know, and then, you know, you have the situation where somebody makes a deal that says, well, I'll vote for your bill if you give me a project for my district, and you go do it. And then the governor vetoes it, and then you're left with nothing, you know, and which seems and is very unfair in the end, but that's the process. I mean, like, it was once said that, you know, life is unfair. If life was fair, Elvis would be alive and all of his impersonators would be dead. So so it's just the way it is. But like anything else in government, it can be misused.
Yeah, and obviously that's kind of the point. But when you think about trying to get your hands around these budgetary actions, I mean, at some point in time, the day of reckoning has to come, right? I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, we just can't keep perpetuating this process.
Absolutely. You know, you look at the federal budget, you look at the state budget, and compare it to where it was 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago. Yeah, you know, these budgets have grown, you know, enormously since then. And it's got to stop. And it's not just, you know, keeping good things from being funded. It's going through the process and cleaning it out. And unfortunately, the DOGE process in Washington, you know, I think it failed because it was much ado about nothing in the end. And but we need it to be more than about nothing. But it needs to be done responsibly. It, you know, you don't want to leave agencies crippled. You want to leave agencies, even if you leave them with less money, you want them to be able to reorganize and use the money effectively and to accomplish goals of legitimate programs. So it's not just doing these things, it's doing them right. And for some reason, state and federal government just doesn't seem to be able to do that very well.
Yeah, once you create an agency, getting it to go away is not a good bet. It's not going to happen easily.
No, it's very difficult.
For sure. Ron, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Always appreciate your time, your insight, and have a great 4th of July weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and text line. Stay with us, folks.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
So the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a bunch of decisions today. The lion's share of them probably you could characterize as saying opposed to positions by the Trump administration. We hear a lot about stacking the court and, you know, the court being just a proxy for the Trump administration. And we seem to forget all those times that they've ruled against the Trump administration, which, you know, it's just kind of curious, the posturing that's going on. The Supreme Court rejected the president's challenge to counting late mail-in ballots and said that the federal law doesn't bar a grace period for mail-in ballots that arrive as long as the postmark was before election day or on election day, that they were received a week or 2 weeks later, depending on the mail service in that area. Some areas seem to be incredibly slow these days from a number of stories that I've read. So it's kind of interesting as we see there. And then in one case, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the administration, which was gives the executive department broader powers relative to agency leaders, except, for example, the Fed, the Federal Reserve. In fact, they kind of delayed on that issue on the one hand relative to one of the members who the president says he's trying to fire for cause. But there were other decisions that were really not in favor of the Trump administration, one being that they didn't take up the case of E. Jean Carroll that he was looking for. So we'll see. Then on another news front, over the weekend, the on-again, off-again ceasefire in Iran is pretty frustrating. Seems as though they will continue peace talks in Doha this weekend, and looks as though Kushner and Witkoff and others will be leading the peace talks there this weekend. As so, we're back on after Iran had fired upon and hit a number, I think two different freighters, one carrying oil. I'm not sure what the second one was, and the U.S. responded over the weekend. This is getting very confusing as to exactly where we are on any of these issues. And again, I continue to have my suspicions about who it is that we're actually negotiating with, who's in charge in Iran, and is any of this really worth the paper it's written on at the end of the day? And it just seems to get a little muckier as each day progresses. Obviously, the characterization of all of this is changing. It's not as strong language being used as to what this means. Even now, there's the interpretation of the MOU is all over the map as to what it actually is, what it isn't. And, it's kind of just hard to think about where this is all going to end up. And as we go to the text line, how much do you think that Doge will end up costing? I don't know if part of the problem with the Doge effort, it was pointed out by Ron Fauché, they tried to do too much too fast, and the reason being in D.C., if you move at a snail's pace, they will bury you. The quicker that you can move through the process, the harder it is for the bureaucracy to respond in real time and to garner the support necessary within Congress to try and put a check on whatever the authority is trying to be exercised. So they moved at a lightning speed. And when you do so, you take missteps, and they did. And I don't think it was a well thought out plan, Is it a necessary plan? Absolutely. Does anybody believe that we are spending our dollars efficiently? When you hear some of these programs that we're financing overseas, it's like, what are we doing? How is that connected to the best interests or the national security interests of this country? Why are we providing all of this sustenance overseas? We're not even taking care of our own. We have a Social Security program that's in the toilet. And although, and everybody said, well, that's not enough money. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's less of a problem if we direct that to Social Security than the problem we have right now. I mean, there's not going to be any one check or any one program that we're going to eliminate that's going to resolve Social Security. But you take this in small steps. You discipline yourself to start saving money. We had what we thought was 10 years. Now we're finding out it may not be 10 years. It may be something less than that as we begin to get really honest about where we are. And we begin to look at some of the programs that we're funding and how much this administration has contributed to the national debt. Yes, they have contributed to that debt structure, probably in the neighborhood of about $4 trillion. We're not talking about that at all. We want to gloss over that situation, but it's getting ugly, and it's getting uglier by the day. And there's not going to be just one signing of a check that's going to resolve this issue. It's about discipline, and it's about making tough decisions and what we're going to be willing to finance. We can't be all things to all people. And that was kind of my point this morning, you know, relative to what we ask the state to finance and this and that and everything else. And this isn't just about the city of New Orleans. This is about every parish. I mean, we got to get smart about what we're doing. We have limited revenue out there, and we can't be looking to other folks to resolve our problems, whether it's the federal government. I understand that we're playing this game all the time of influence peddling and this and that and who's going to get what and this for financing and everything else. But we've moved away from the core responsibilities of government and financing it in a meaningful way so that you, me, and other taxpayers can feel the appropriate outcome of these programs where we see that it is moving and changing our lives in a meaningful way. And when we don't see that is when this frustration and the skepticism and the cynicism of all that is going on, and we turn out with, 17% of the vote turning out in a senatorial election? It's a joke. It's an absolute joke. So at some point in time, you and I and the rest of the voting public has to stop being lazy and start doing our homework and electing folks that say what they mean what they say. And not just, talk about things. I mean, when I hear Julia Letlow talk about how this is not this election is not about ours, it's about yours. Really? Well, Trump's perspective is a little bit different. And as you pointed out in her words, not mine, President Trump is the greatest president ever. Now, I don't believe that. I like a lot of his policies. He's not even close, in my mind, to being the greatest president ever. But this is what I'm talking about. We've signed a blood oath, right? So whatever the game is going to be, so for example, the housing bill is going to get held up, bipartisan bill, unless we pass the SAVE Act. And now we're fighting about that, which is about election laws. We're set up as a constitutional republic. Part of the reason that we did it, our forefathers did it that way, was this skepticism about a centralized government, about having those checks and balances, right? But we're doing things completely and totally contrary because we don't like the way that certain folks want to handle it. Instead of just trying to improve upon their system, meaning making sure that they have adequate safeguards in place there, and taking the time necessary in order to do it, to educate the public and otherwise, and develop a strategy over years. No, we're going to have this overreaction to these things and try and do a bunch of different things that folks just simply don't want to do. We're fortunate here. I mean, we've done it, I think, the right way for a long time, until we moved away from, you know, our jungle primary system, and we went to this closed primary system for, you know, obviously for protection of a certain sector of the party as opposed to the entire party, and giving the public the ability to vote. But here we go, you know, and we'll see where this ends up in the end about this. But going back to where I started, Democrats talking about stacking the court. Today, in the decisions that were made, they were winners. Got four major decisions yet to be made at this U.S. Supreme Court. And maybe tomorrow those will come down, or maybe sometime this afternoon. I'm not sure. We shall see. We'll be right back.
Football is fun. Why shouldn't your football podcast be the same?
Follow and listen to Heed the Call NFL podcast with Dan Hansis and Mark Sessler wherever you get your podcasts.
Stay with us. Well, welcome back, folks. America's 250th birthday this 4th of July. And we are joined by the Debbie Bressler, Crescent City Countdown Club. Debbie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. It's hard to believe we're talking about 4th of July all over again. Right now, what is it, 33 years, I think, 34 years we've been working with this, and you guys have certainly helped it grow into the international event that it's become.
Well, you guys do a great job. Y'all work really, really hard at it. Most everybody's a volunteer that's part of this show, and it's incredible. So let's go through the lineup. I know the fireworks show, 9 p.m., the night of July the 4th.
That's right, and it's the backdrop of our 250th birthday celebration, and it's going to be some very unusual fireworks, starting with a very special effect. It's a rapid launch barrage of red, white, and blue comet tails that reach 150 feet high in the air and start a 45-degree angle going up and down the river, repeating it six times toward the Crescent City Connection Bridge. It is going to be amazing as you watch this paint the sky with all these patriotic colors.
Y'all improve every year. It's amazing what they do with the pyrotechnic capabilities of these folks. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely phenomenal, right?
It really is. And we've been going to Pyromania for the last year. They are amazing. They're a Louisiana-based company, and they are just the most unusual shells, and they really work with us. And understanding, as you know, the struggles we have with making this happen every year, we start over and have to go out. And this has been a tough year for everybody, but we were determined. And I've got to say that this year it is presented in partnership with the New Orleans Tourism and Cultural Foundation and presented by New Orleans and Company, the Burger Company, Pyromania, Magic 101.9, and of course, WWL, and our real life Uncle Sam Zito, who this year, Newell, they donated the entire marine part of the show, which is what's enabled us to be able to make it this year. So our real Uncle Sam Zito with Zito come. It's wonderful. We're really so, so very lucky. Because, I mean, it's not, you know, nonprofits, and we just want to make it happen. This is our tradition, and we need this. And, of course, you can see it on the east and west banks of the river, from the Hilton New Orleans Riverside to the Goldring Woldenberg Riverfront Park. So you have to cop a squat there. You can come early and see the Calliope concerts with the Steamboat Natchez that going. Also ride the river on the Natchez and the paddle wheel of Creole Queen. And the Hilton New Orleans Riverside is going to have a riverfront pool party. So it's a cool way to watch the fireworks from there. So it's just, you know, we're getting creative, and the General Kelly, of course, will make its appearance, which is very popular. So.
I don't know. I had this vision of Debbie out there with these little portable pools, renting them out to watch the 4th of July.
It is a good idea. It's like just wherever they are, start filling them up. That's a good idea because it is hot. But we say, come on down early. We've got places to eat. There's so many things to do. And, of course, the fireworks are going to be phenomenal. And, you know, everybody has tried to make this happen this year. All my fellow nonprofit people, it is a struggle, as we all know. And we just want to thank you guys for staying with us and helping us to continue to build this. You know, firsthand, you've watched it with our dear friend Helen, how, you know, every year we're just not sure where to go with this. And it always happens because people come through. But we have to start from zero every year. So,
yeah. And I think the General Roy S. Kelly fireboat will be out there again with its beautiful plumes of red, white, and blue water shooting out of their water cannons.
They will, from 6:30 to 7 p.m. So you want to get down there to see this. It's the dye is put in. It's an amazing scene. And being such an old historic boat, you know, it's just a part of the history. It was built in 1994. Used by the Port of New Orleans to fight fires, give tours, conduct search and rescue missions on the river. So it's got personality of its own. So,
absolutely. Any other events that are going on along with the show this year? We got the Natchez, Canal Place, the Westin, Creole Queen, Hilton New Orleans Riverside. Any others?
Well, those are a lot of our sponsors, but we do have a lot of events going on. Is it okay if I read our sponsor list, Newell?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So I read the first ones, of course, where we're starting. And then we call the others our True Blue sponsors, Canal Place, Downtown Development, Special Friends of the Riverfront Marketing Group, Paddle Wheeler, Creole Queen, the Port of New Orleans, Steamboat Natchez and Greylon Tours, the Missy Bomasinas, the Western New Orleans, and our new one, New Orleans Chamber of Commerce, and the French Quarter Business Association called to say they wanted to contribute this year. Of course, our media sponsors being Odyssey, ExperienceNewOrleans.com, French Quarterly Magazine, and Vincent Simmons Photography. And, of course, we're grateful for all the services and safety provided by the City of New Orleans. So we're really lucky that it takes about 25, 27 sponsors just to pull this together and make it happen.
And this year, with the 4th being on a Saturday, I mean, I got to imagine that that's going to work really great for you guys, and the crowds ought to be huge.
I'm hoping so. And I hear that there are all kind of parties already gathering and being put together on the West Bank. And, of course, if you go to our website at goforthontheriver.com or to WWL.com, you'll see what all of our sponsors are offering with special coupons. And you can also see where to park and everything that's going on there, because it's a wonderful way to celebrate our 250th birthday. However, I've got to tell you, and I don't know if you've heard of this, I was told about the Historic New Orleans Collection exhibit, American Revolution, the Augmented Exhibition, and it really connects us. It is really focuses on other national events, but it highlights the role that the Gulf South and New Orleans played. Then we were a Spanish colony in the fight for our independence. And if you go to the Historic New Orleans Collection, it's going to be there through January. It's all the special effects by a French company. It's called Histrovie. And it's, you use a histopad to explore and experience all of these different events. So it connects us. It's the fireworks are there as a backdrop for it all. But this really tells the story. And I just encourage anybody. I can't wait to go see it. So.
Well, Debbie, again, congratulations to you and your group and all the folks and all of the sponsors. Couldn't happen without them. We're happy to be a part of it. And thank you so much for taking on this endeavor each and every year. It means a lot to the city. Debbie Bresler, Crescent City Countdown Club. See you Saturday.
Thank you so much, Newell. Happy 4th of July.
Same to you. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Don't forget, folks, 9 o'clock, the fireworks show starts on Saturday, July the 4th, in honor of the 250th birthday of this country. All right, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Guy Williams, Chairman and CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Rent freeze passes in New York City, what that means for landlords and tenants, the odd approach to high summertime temperatures in England and France, the economics of the current situation in the Strait of Hormuz, and the World Cup economic impact, and what factors cause countries to succeed in World Cup soccer, and more of what's trending out there, both internationally, nationally, and here locally. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Guy Williams, Chairman and CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, real people tell their stories live on stage.
I burst into tears. And I wasn't sure if I was crying because I hadn't been kissed in a really long time or if I had just never been kissed like that before.
To hear fascinating, heartbreaking, and sometimes hilarious stories from astronauts, teachers, farmers, and people just like you, follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.